SaaS Backwards is sponsored by Austin Lawrence Group, specializing in demand gen for SaaS. It sure is noisy. I deleted 100 emails from vendors just this morning. Your buyer has gotten better at ignoring you, and you're gonna need a big idea if you want to cut through all that clutter. Austin Lawrence is just the right agency to help you find it. So if your campaigns are falling on deaf eyeballs, let's talk. Visit austinlawrence.com today, and let's build something bigger.
Welcome to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, where we reverse engineer the success of fast-growing SaaS firms and explore strategies CMOs and CEOs are using to drive their businesses forward.
Welcome to SaaS Backwards, a podcast that helps SaaS CEOs and CMOs to accelerate growth and enhance profitability. Our guest today is Shannon Curran, Vice President Marketing at Mad Kudu, a revenue automation intelligence platform that brings focus to revenue teams by predicting and prioritizing all the right revenue-generating actions. Hey, Shannon, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ken. So nice to be here.
Thanks so much. Hey, before we jump in, I'd love you to tell our listeners just a little bit more about yourself and the company you work for.
Awesome. So yeah, as you said, my name is Shannon Curran, and I'm the VP of Marketing at Mad Kudu. And previous to this role, before this, I was in venture capital. And then before that, was in B2B tech, and then spent the first few years of my career always in marketing, but in different industries. So I was in healthcare, nonprofit, and then moved my way into higher ed. So it's a little bit of an unconventional path, but really happy with where it's brought me.
Well, it sounds like it's been something of a survey course in the ways to use marketing to drive organizational accomplishment. So it makes some sense to me.
Yeah.
Hey, tell us a little bit also about Mad Kudu before we jump in. First of all, interesting company name, but what does it do? And I'll tell people why they might want to learn a little more about it before we get into the planned conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mad Kudu, the reason, so a kudu is a kind of an antelope. You'll see in our logo, the antlers. And it's a very sweet story of how the name was created, which our founders are data scientists and they used AI to create the name. So it's a very classic story that's very special to the brand. And once you hear it, once you know it, you don't forget it. So I think that it is certainly a name that people constantly ask us how to pronounce. But so yeah, we started off really as a predictive lead scoring platform that worked a lot with companies that are running a hybrid funnel. So folks that are running PLG, as well as inbound and outbound. And over the years, we have grown to be what we're now calling a revenue automation intelligence engine. So we sit across your entire go-to-market org and help your revenue teams prioritize and predict revenue generating actions that we know will drive revenue. So the world right now is full of noise. If you're a person in marketing, I know you feel this really hard, that there's just so many signals all over the place. And it's really hard to tell what your team should be acting on to know that they're driving revenue. And I think you're going to hear the word efficiency a lot in the last year, especially. You don't want your team focused on anything that's not going to drive revenue. So we're seeing a lot of success with companies that are running multiple motions. So we're trying to get away from the conversation around go-to-market motions and trying to get to the idea of revenue driving signals. And we're seeing a lot of success with those folks driving a lot of their revenue for a very small amount of their business, right? So they're able to focus their teams and really use data to drive truth in their organization instead of drive chaos.
Well, I mean, who likes chaos? And but I think the essential point here is really important, that teams need to know where to focus their effort. The Pareto principle pretty much applies, the 80-20 rule. Mm-hmm. And almost, it's like incredible how it applies. So I think that's part of your thought process, right? Is that we should be looking where the bulk of the revenue is going to come for the least amount of wasted effort.
Absolutely. And we find that with a lot of our customers, when they come in, less than 10% of their MQLs are driving 90% of their revenue. So you're seeing that a lot of businesses have been growing at all costs over the last few years and just trying to get as much in the funnel as possible. And now as things are starting to slow down a little, you're seeing a real strong want to prioritize and predict exactly where that revenue is going to come from and make sure you're driving more and more of the stuff that looks like closed won and less of the stuff that doesn't. So yeah.
Is this a tool operating in the sales world, marketing world, or both?
Yeah. So historically, we have sold to marketing teams. So we really worked very closely, specifically with marketing and revenue operations. But as we've kind of gone up org chart and have continued to work with more customers, we're seeing ourselves talking to VPs of sales, VPs of marketing, CROs that are really focused on understanding where their revenue is coming from and focusing their teams. So we're building more and more features for sales specifically so that they don't have to go outside of their current platforms. They don't have to sign into anything new, but they can get all of the signals that they need on their accounts to prospect effectively. And we're also starting to work with customer success. So to be able to predict which of your accounts are going to churn, which ones are really great potential for upsell, and really understand your accounts more deeply, specifically from their product usage, as well as any other third-party data that we can collect on them so that you have a great understanding of your accounts.
That's really interesting because, you know, a lot of our work starts with defining, you know, the ideal customer, doing some work on personas and stuff like that. It sounds like this could be a way to augment that traditional approach to building out those assets.
Definitely. And a big piece of our platform is our segmentation, right? So we build a model based on your closed one. And then also you can augment it as you see fit that are the best fit customers for your product. And that it's not a subjective discussion from sales or marketing around what is best. The models are really able to tell you, and you're able to also continue to iterate on them as your business changes. So we're seeing a lot of harmony being created between sales and marketing as well, which is something that I know every company has been trying to figure out for all time, but really aligning them around revenue truth. The idea that all we're trying to do is close revenue, right? Both of these teams specifically, and then also customer success. So the aligning everyone around the truth around the data so that there's no more subjective discussion around what does a good deal look like.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I don't usually spend so much time on product in these podcasts, mm-hmm. but this is a subject really dear to my heart. And I think almost every marketer out there is struggling with, you know, pressure on budget, if not reduced budget. Like, you know, it's mm-hmm. a prove it kind of mentality now. And I just think this is a really important topic, but I want to move into some of the things we said we'd talk about because, you know, our audience is not just people who might very well benefit from MadKudu, but also people like yourself who are, you know, trying to manage their own careers, trying to manage their own success in their organizations. And I wanted to sort of delve back into your background and how you got into tech marketing. Cause I think that, you know, every once in a while we run into someone who came out from another background into tech and had a lot of success. And I just want to ask you to illuminate that for others who might be thinking about that career path.
Definitely. So yeah, I went to an art school, came out of school wanting to work in nonprofit, did that, but tough time in the market to get a job. Definitely very different than some of the folks I've hired in the last few years. And so I was a marketing team of one at a nonprofit at my first job. And then I knew I really wanted to go and get my MBA. It's something that I felt pretty strongly about, but I didn't want to pay for it. So I was looking for jobs that would be possible. And I ended up actually working in public relations at college. So in higher ed at a really excellent business school, I went to Babson. And I went there part-time while I worked long 4 years, but it really opened my eyes to the potential of different career paths. And in my first tech-related course, I was like, oh, this is where I want to be. I was like, I feel like this is the right pace for me. I think this is something that I'm taking my background in communications and marketing and being able to describe these like really esoteric and complicated technologies and making them relevant to the end user is something that I felt really passionate about. So as I was continuing my education, I decided right before I was done to leave my current job and to go work in tech. So got an opportunity to work at a PE-backed company in Boston called QuickBase. And I worked for an excellent leadership team that really grew me very quickly. I got a lot of opportunity there to then become a people manager and to manage multiple functions. So I come up through content marketing. So came in there as an individual contributor content marketer and grew into one of their senior managers that managed all of our brand, content, comms, started to build out integrated campaigns and had a really excellent experience growing quickly there during COVID, which was also really a very insane time for tech. I ran really fast and I, at that time, had a few offers to potentially go into startups. And I knew I maybe wanted to at some point, but I didn't feel like I could make a super educated decision on where to go. And then I got an offer from OpenView Venture Capital to come and build their content and brand engine internally. And I never planned to go onto that side of the money. That was not my plan, but it felt like a really good move for me to be able to evaluate a future opportunity, either a Series A or a Series B. So I moved to VC and worked there for a little over a year. I definitely felt like I probably wasn't a VC lifer, but I loved working with founders. This is something I did at Babson a lot too, is the school for entrepreneurship. So worked a lot with founders. And so got to spend a good amount of time advising as well as creating content that resonated with founders. The content program at OpenView is excellent, right? So
remarkable.
It's really excellent. And it was definitely a test in quality, which is something that is not always at the forefront when you're working at a startup. And so it was a different muscle and I got to build a really excellent team there. And then when I decided to go back into operating, I felt like I had a great network and then also a really great understanding of the questions to ask in an interview process, how to evaluate a company, how to know if it's somewhere you really want to be, especially if you're going to be a member of the leadership team, because I was looking at VP roles and that means you're really investing in the success of that brand and your personal brand is tied to the success of that company, right? So I felt like I was in a really good position to be able to do that. And so obviously there were many fumbles along the way, but it sounds linear now that I can look back on it. But I think a lot about just following the work that inspires you, right? So that you're excited by. I didn't have a plan. I just followed work that really felt like it was going to be engaging for me.
I think for folks a little younger than you and a little younger than me, there's some stuff to take away from this. And I just want to highlight a couple of things. First of all, you know, liberal arts education, I'm a huge believer in it. And I think that learning to learn and, you know, exercising your mind is a life skill. And, you know, both my kids have, you know, liberal arts education and have gone on to do really great things. And it's underappreciated, I think. So if there's anybody really young listening to this, don't be afraid to go get that liberal arts.
Yeah.
The idea of going into education as a first career choice, really interesting, by the way. But I think really smart. You know, most of these schools offer the graduate education, right, as part of the attraction to work for them. And I think that combination of, you know, liberal arts and having an MBA, really powerful way to jump into actual work. So
yeah,
which is really a terrible way to discount the marketing of a higher education, but perhaps the technology workforce, right? So the great way to get there. And I just think it's worth highlighting that stuff. I think you and I discussed OpenView and pricing at some point, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned to me they have that pricing, do-it-yourself pricing kit.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. So OpenView is very good at building out playbooks for startups, right? They only invest in B2B tech at the expansion stage. So it's a very clear market. And so it was a really excellent way to create content because there's a lot of similarities around those founders, right? So I worked a lot with the team there around a usage-based pricing playbook, as well as product benchmarks, as well as financial and operating benchmarks, lots of different kind of core topics that a lot of companies are really trying to manage and deal with at that growing stage, which also has helped me a lot being in one of those companies now to be able to say, hey, is our pricing usage-based? If not, if we're seat-based, how can we make a more collaborative model? What are our competitors doing? It definitely has helped me a lot understand the landscape of these decisions and not just make it kind of like a one company decision. And also I still, you know, obviously keep in touch with folks there. So able to really understand what's the new and the greatest across the portfolio and then across kind of like the industry.
Yeah. You know, it's a little shout out for those guys because we certainly refer entrepreneurs, you know, CEOs and CMOs to those resources all the time.
Yeah.
They just publish too much good stuff. It makes it hard to stand out.
Yeah.
I really liked part of our conversation when we did the prep on vetting the next possible job. And that's a thing, right? I mean, people in marketing leadership roles, they're in there for 18 to 36 months. And so this is something you're going to have to do 6, 7, 8 times in a career.
Don't remind me.
Yeah, sorry. But I think it's a really important topic because it's really easy to be dazzled by opportunities that come your way. And I think it's important to take a look at the process you went through because you did some good stuff. So you want to talk about vetting the next job for people?
Sure. And this is something that I feel like I've learned a lot since. So this was my first time going into vetting a VP role. And I had a lot of great support and a good network, but I've now learned there's lots of things I could have asked that I did not know since then. Lots of things I could have asked for in terms of, you know, lots of different specific things to put in a contract, things like that, right? So I'm not an exact expert, but what I really did is I started with my network. I felt very lucky that I was able to get into a lot of conversations pretty quickly. So I thought I wanted to go to a Series C, which is interesting originally, but I wanted someone that had raised a round with a valuation that the math made sense to me in the last 6 months. So I started at Mad Kudu in November of last year. So not a lot of folks had raised in the 6 months before that. I was very wary of anyone that had raised in 2021 or 2020 because I knew the valuations were really hard to make the math work on. And I saw kind of the writing on the wall of where potentially the market was going. So I wanted to make sure that they were well funded, that they had a really good understanding of their CAC, as well as their LTV, so their lifetime values of their customers, and that their churn was pretty low, right? Like that's what I was looking at. So that's like from a business perspective, what I was looking at. Also, always ask to sign an NDA in those hiring processes so that you can actually see their board memo and their books. And if you're not a person that like is super financially savvy, make sure you have someone in your network that you can ask specific questions to around specific metrics you should be looking at. Because that's not like, you know, I do have an MBA, but I squeaked by in finance. I should never be your CFO, but I do know the important kind of metrics specifically for the revenue team to understand how successful can we be? How much runway do we have? Are we ever going to be able to reach our valuation based on that runway? Things like that. So that's where I think you should certainly ask for an NDA in that process to be able to look at that. The other thing is, are the founders seasoned? So are they first-time founders? Are they second-time founders? That's excellent. Third-time founders? Do they have a strong network of advisors that they take to heart their feedback? Do they have a board that is diverse, even in terms of background? So do they have, you know, our current board has early stage investors, as well as the folks that invested in our Series A, as well as independent seats. Like, is their board really well-rounded? And is their board really involved? So do you meet with the board as a VP interviewing? If not, that could be a pretty big red flag that if the board doesn't want to meet with the leadership team, at least one person on the board, right? And I think this is a little squishier, but are the founders someone that you want to ride behind to build a great business? Are they someone that you believe in? And that was the thing that cinched me for Mad Kudu, is that the CEO, Sam, is someone that I feel like he is very unique. He is thoughtful, data-driven, but also has go-to-market chops. He is so focused on personal growth as well as growth of the company. The company was super thoughtful when I joined, and they were Series A and didn't need to be. And so like, I want to build a great business with these people, right? And that made a difference to me. So some of this stuff is a little squishier and you have to trust your gut, but other things I think are more concrete to be able to look at to understand the financials.
So I think there's good learning there for people like yourself and maybe also people in the C-suite looking to hire talent, right? This is what it looks like now.
Yeah. And if there was a recent VP that left, like get the real understanding of why they're not there anymore. Right? Like that's another thing, right? Like if a bunch of other people have tried to do this job and they haven't been able to do it yet, like what makes you a unique fit, right? And I think this is something I think about in hiring in general, but stage of company is almost more important than role fit because you need such a different skill set at a Series A than you do at a Series B, than you do at a Series C, right? Than you do at a private equity health company, right? It's a DNA that I think you need to be really comfortable at a Series A with being a little reckless and understanding how to take big swings, being okay if they don't work, pivoting quickly, which is a very different skill set than the kind of optimization skill set of someone that is maybe working in PE or at a larger company. So do you have that kind of right DNA for the role? And are you hiring the right folks with the right DNA?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think not only, you know, are you willing to take those risks, but is it okay if the ground beneath you shifts, right? You have to be okay with that.
Yep.
So let's turn our attention back to marketing at Mad Kudu, if we can. Mm-hmm. So when we spoke 6 weeks ago, you were just starting to work on messaging change.
Yep.
And that's a hard nut to crack sometimes. And, you know, in our work, we're often bringing new ideas, new messaging, and sometimes it's fabulous and we get it all right. Not the messaging. Usually that's okay. It's the process. Sometimes we don't get the process right. Can you talk a little bit about messaging change at Mad Kudu and how you did get alignment? Because I think that's really worthy.
Yeah, so it was a longer project. And I think it's one of those that this is something that I have experience in. And that's why I was really excited to come into a company that needed this. So Mad Kudu historically was known as a platform for product-led sales, right? Had a very strong tie to the PLG community, but the product was so much more than that. And I felt that in my interview process as well. And this is coming from the venture capital firm that created PLG. So obviously I have a pretty strong love for it and a good understanding of it. But I was like, this product can do just so much more than just ingest product usage data into a CRM, right? Like it does a lot more than that. Not that that's not an important thing to do, but that's not the value prop of Mad Kudu. And so as I came in, we started to shift the conversation from PLG to a conversation around hybrid funnels. And so the way that we were testing this is that we are listening to a ton of customer calls. The good thing about a Series A is your customers actually often bought from your founders. So they are close to you and they're willing to take calls all the time and they want you to be successful. Some of them are investors. So they are like really invested in the company growing. And we have some customers that have bought us now 4 or 5 times, right? And so we're able to get really close to those folks as well as advisors in the space, our board, and start testing messaging constantly. So before we embarked on like a big messaging project, we just started testing. So we started running biweekly tests on our website, on our H1s. We started testing on paid advertising. And we were learning very quickly as we started to migrate our messaging away from PLG and into this conversation around hybrid funnels. Is it budget allocation? Like, what is it exactly that people are really buying us for as we're starting to see expansion within accounts? So I knew going into Q2 that we really needed to invest specifically in not just messaging, but positioning. So very crowded market, MarTech, RevTech, revenue intelligence, like the most crowded of all crowded. I guess maybe cyber might be a little more, but it's just very crowded, right? So I wanted to bring an objective third party in to be able to do some really strong research around where do we actually fit based on what our customers are saying, based on what the market is saying, based on kind of where we've been, where we want to go, where the product roadmap is going. And so we worked with a consultant. Her name was Hema. She's excellent. She's pretty much worked only with companies at our stage. She's worked really technical, MarTech, she's worked across. So really good fit for us to engage our executive team in a 6-week process around competitor landscape across where the market is going, where it's been, decisions on do we join a current category? Do we kind of create a niche within a current category that's our own? And we came to a really excellent kind of choice of the fact that we are no longer just a predictive lead scoring platform, but we consider ourselves revenue automation intelligence. So revenue intelligence is a huge category. So you think the Gongs, the Clarys, the Sixth Sense of the world are all in this category. And really where we think we fit is around automating that revenue intelligence. So automating where your revenue is coming from and also automating the intelligence. So no more data grunt work. You don't need like 5 data scientists internally to be able to figure out where your revenue is coming from. So during that process, that 6-week process, I was dripping to my team. So I have a very small team, 3 folks, learnings. And I was like, hey, can you start testing these on the website? Can you test them in paid ads? Maybe we should do a little bit of content on this. Let's test this. Let's run this as an email subject line. So that as we were running this process, we were also doing kind of our own testing. And we were able to get to the end of the process where we made a decision on messaging. And then we were also able to already have some data from our own platforms that this is working. We saw a 2x increase of conversion on our website, specifically on our demo page, when we changed the messaging. Right. So we were able to see a huge increase.
Wait, and this is something could you just say that again?
Yeah. So our demo, we were able to see a 2x increase on our demo request page when we changed the messaging, pivoted from a conversation around like finding your leads and your, I can't even remember what the exact messaging was before. We've gone through so much, but now looking at revenue focus instead of revenue fire drills. Like, do you want to be able to understand how to predict and prioritize your revenue driving signals? So that is where we're seeing a lot of success because that is something that is not just works for outbound, doesn't just work for inbound, doesn't just work for PLG. It is a conversation that all go-to-market teams or revenue teams are having. So it was a multi-pronged process, but we also are launching publicly I'm not sure when this is coming out, but we will launch this positioning publicly at the beginning of August. And we're really excited for folks to continue to give us feedback on it, to be able to poke holes in it. Love that. We've been doing this all along, and to really better understand the value that we bring. So yeah, it was a lot of work, but I think we're starting to see some really good success from it.
So that was a lot of internal stuff within your team, and it's a small team trying to do a lot. There's a lot to unpack here. First of all, you brought in an advisor to help you structure this process. And I imagine that helps also because it's not just you saying it, right? You have someone who's done it before who can say, hey, this is what I've seen with X, Y, and Z. So you got your own team on board. How did you get the wider team on board? Because this is a big change.
Yeah. So I think messaging was a pain that the whole company was feeling. So I think that is really critical, right? So I've been at companies before where like people love the current messaging. Like they've been there for 10 plus years. They feel like they understand the customer. And then the marketing team is trying to push them in a new direction. And it's like, no, I like my old colors. I liked the old messaging. Like it works for me, right? We have a very small team. So, you know, we have two AEs, we have two SDRs, we have a team of four on the marketing team, right? And, you know, our company itself is about, I think, 45 now. And everyone was feeling the pain of like, our messaging is not quite working, right? Like our AEs are doing extemporaneous jazz on calls. You have the marketing team really feeling like they don't know where to focus. Customer success is wanting to have a better pitch to be able to understand renewals and upsells. And so I think there was a big hunger for this already. And this is something that we're still in the process of rolling it out internally, but we are trying to drum up some excitement for folks and really get this like crisp one-liner that everyone's been asking for the last year. So I think it's more like people were hungry for it. So they're pretty open to being like, all right, I'll try it. Like I've been struggling to be able to articulate this myself over that time.
So not only did you have the problem awareness, but you also had some data, right? So it wasn't like you just said, you know, here's my shiny idea. Let's all rally around it. I think that's an important part of this narrative is that we have the tools now where we can test stuff out and come back with this kind of report, which says, hey, here's what we're doing today. Here's that baseline. We tried these five things and look what happened over here. And by the way, it also fits really well with where you're trying to take the product. So I think that being willing to test and learn with an ongoing concern is maybe not on everyone's radar, but a little test and learn, I think, is good for business. And we certainly try and get people to do that.
Yeah.
Is there anything, I've run into this, and so I want to ask you, this is a little, a slight curveball, not a bad one.
It's okay.
Was there anything that you needed to trademark that you wrote? And, you know, have you run into any obstacles with trademarking?
So we haven't had to just yet because our positioning is really around like a thought, like not necessarily like a new name or anything like that. I have dealt with this also. We're doing a rebrand at another company. Like our logo was too close to one of a large corporate, like things like that. Like I have dealt with that in my past, but no, we haven't had to run into that yet at MadKudu. But I do think it's critical for going back to your other question of how you help become successful is going positioning first, messaging second. Because positioning is analytical, it's data-driven, it looks at the competitive landscape, and then the messaging comes out of that, and then branding comes out of that. So I think sometimes where folks can fall down is like, hey, look at our new colors, and they do that first. And people just don't even think, they're like, okay, whatever, like the marketing team changes colors every 6 months, like I don't care. Whereas this was, our founders were the face of this change. And this is an understanding of our competitive landscape, an understanding of the value we bring to customers, where our roadmap is going, you know, how we're integrated in generative AI, like all these big things, right, that are really critical and everyone's feeling, and then how it looks and what it's called comes second.
All right. So you opened Pandora's box here. How will generative AI fit in with this product?
Yeah. So it's an interesting place for products that were already based on machine learning and artificial intelligence, because if, you know, 5 years ago, you weren't going to say your product was AI because it scared everybody, right? They were like, I don't get it. Like, it's too confusing. Like, I don't, like, I don't understand. And now it's like every product is .AI, you know? So for products like ours that, you know, our predictive models are based on machine learning and artificial intelligence, it is interesting to say, how do we kind of talk about what we've always been doing? but in a different way that people are now understanding that it's important. And then obviously we're integrating a ton more into our product. We're thinking a lot about the head of our product team, our CPO, our co-founder, Francis, often talks about Mad Kudu as your, as a coworker. So as your revenue co-pilot, as the person next to you that's doing all of like that grunt work so that your teams can finally sell again, your teams can market again, your teams can actually do what they got into the job to do. And a lot of that is obviously AI. So I had this conversation with someone recently, feeling really good about our product team's ability to continue to grow in this space. It didn't feel like a huge pivot. It just felt like a continuation and a bigger investment in folks now trusting AI and wanting it to do more for them.
Cool. Hey, so I want to ask you my favorite question, which is, hey, if you look back, are there any decisions you made that you'd love another shot at and why?
Yeah, I think I would ask, it's funny, because I come up in content marketing, I'm not used to spending a lot of money on marketing or understanding that a lot of stuff costs money. And this is something that I think I would have gotten more bullish on early on is keep spending and asking until they tell you to stop. And that is something that I have looked back on and saw, like, we could have grown faster if I had just pushed on saying we needed to spend more, we needed to invest more. That is something that as a VP, I'm learning a lot, because I think my natural inclination is like, how much can we do for free? And I think that's coming up. I know a lot of folks I know that are in demand gen are like the exact opposite. They're like, well, everything costs a lot of money. We can't do anything for free, right? So I think that that's something, it's not one particular moment, but certainly a skill set I look back on. And yeah. And I'm like, I should have asked more. Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting. You know, certainly I had a podcast guest on recently, Melissa Rosenthal. She's the chief creative officer at ClickUp. And really shook my snow globe, because we've been doing content marketing here for quite some time. And you're absolutely right. Budgets are pretty small compared to what we did historically as an integrated agency in the past, where advertising budgets could be in the, you know, high six figures or, you know, more than $1 million in a B2B space for small companies, relatively small companies spending tons. And what I realized is that we've missed a lot of opportunity to grow faster, become more prominent more quickly, because we aren't recommending and not, therefore our clients aren't allocating the money to get the message in front of people, right? Yep. So we've sort of downed the inbound Kool-Aid and sort of left behind some of the things that made our message more broadly available and consumable. So speaking really about advertising and paid ways to get in front of people that, you know, I think certainly in our practice are going to be much more important going forward.
So yeah, you need to spend to grow, you know, like that is something that is not the most comfy for me, but is something I definitely know and is something that I am continuing to get better at as I continue to lead my team into more growth phases. So,
well, that's awesome. This was really a wonderful conversation. Thanks so much. If people want to learn more about Mad Kudu or connect with you, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find us at madkudu.com. Certainly no one owns that other than us. So that was a part of the naming. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. I'm Shannon Curran, Shannon Sweeney Curran. That's my maiden name. And you can also find the Mad Kudu team on LinkedIn. And yeah, really looking forward to connecting with more folks and always open for DMs if people have questions or want to chat more.
Thanks so much. And I'm on LinkedIn/in/Ken Lempit. Our agency website is austinlawrence.com. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, you can do so wherever podcasts are distributed. Shannon Curran, thanks for a great conversation and best of luck.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, brought to you by Austin Lawrence Group. We're a growth marketing agency that helps SaaS firms reduce churn, accelerate sales, and generate demand. Learn more about us at www.austinlawrence.com. You can email Ken Lempit at kl@austinlawrence.com about any SaaS marketing or customer retention subject. We hope you'll subscribe, and thanks again for listening.